What this is pointing to is if you're going to get at globalization, the number one priority is not external solidarity. It's not symbolic protest of corporations, which are symptomatic of the whole. It's not putting up posters or saying chants or writing better songs opposing all forms of killing and war as a platitudinal process. It's about undertaking the nuts and bolts, get down and dirty, gritty operation of decolonizing Native North America, restoring self-determining rights to Native people, restoring control over our entitled land base and the resources that attend it to the indigenous population whose property, whose destiny, whose legal, moral, and natural prerogatives to enjoyment thereof it is. There is no other agenda item that will address globalization in negative terms that has any particular meaning absent that. And I'm going to go further. But let me restate that one. If you want to effectively oppose globalization in the present form, in the form that is forthcoming in the immediate future, you have to undo the component parts that made it possible in the first place. And those component parts are the creation of the internal colonial structure of Native North America, overarched by these superstrates. You have to decolonize Native North America. Priority number one. And that does not mean that you abandon all other priorities, both in the sense that one is seldom vested with a sole priority. There's usually a range of them. They form, oh, dastardly word, it's probably going to cause shockwaves of horror, hierarchy. The reason we don't have priorities, perhaps, is because intellectually we've gotten into opposing some abstraction called hierarchy. And in our opposition to it, we've come up with brilliant slogans like, there is no hierarchy to oppression. Excuse me. There is no hierarchy to oppression, say people who are opposed to the hierarchy, the, with a capital T and a capital H, the hierarchy. We're opposed to the hierarchy who oppresses us. It's a hierarchy, but of course it wouldn't oppress us in a hierarchical fashion, would it? The hierarchy will work in an anti-hierarchical manner, will unto me, in contradiction, giveth a break. If it's a hierarchy that's doing the oppression, then of course the oppression is going to be hierarchical. It's going to have preferred targets. It's going to have lesser targets, okay? And we need to understand those. We need to understand the hierarchy, and on that basis form some priorities of what our limited resources are going to be devoted to engaging. And priorities in themselves are a hierarchy. If you're going to have priorities, you're going to have to embrace rather than reject hierarchy in principle. There's particular forms of hierarchy you may be able to oppose properly, but not hierarchy in principle. So, now I've addressed postmodernism as well as postcolonialism. Thank you. But guess what? In the tracing of the historical genealogy, you find that the forms of oppression that are visited by other people in North America, whether it's in Canada or whether it's in the United States, whether we're talking about racism or classism or sexism or ageism or environmental devastation or any of the rest of these objectionable things, are all predicated on the conquest and colonization of Native North America. They couldn't have done any of that that came after without doing that which came before. If you decolonize Native North America, you eliminate the basis for these other kinds of oppression, okay? And so you're solving your own immediate agenda in the process of accomplishing something broader, and what on earth could be wrong with that? See, we're a little hierarchy, self-interest, in confluence with compassion for others and a recognition of the problem can get you. Probably not published, but... yeah. So, okay, that's sort of the summative thing on globalization. And I'm not going to take it much further on that front right now. I'm going to leave that for Q&A. I think I've laid out enough to either excite or irritate enough people that we can probably have interchange on it. And again, I've intentionally left a whole lot that probably needed to be said out, partly in order to shape it in interaction with you, but I think you got the drift of what I'm talking about there. So let me go on to the other part of what is supposed to be involved in what I was going to say tonight, and then I'll shut down and we'll get into the rough and tumble into things. And that goes to the relationship between globalization on the one hand and genocide on the other. And I'm approaching this from the premise that people understand that genocide in and of itself is something to be opposed, but there's whole molecular strings of implication in terms of mentality and practices string out of the phenomena of genocide that have negative implications for everyone involved or around the process, including even the perpetrators, and on that score, ask the Germans. They know real well. Well, what I've done is make an argument in the globalization end of things that globalization itself is simply an ever more evolutionary form of colonial consolidation. And that takes me to another mighty French intellectual, this one by the name of Jean-Paul Sartre, who in 1968, as a corollary endeavor to Lord Russell's tribunal, which was dedicated to examining charges of U.S. war crimes in Southeast Asia, a neocolonial endeavor, took on the study as to whether the allegations that what the U.S. was engaged in was actually, in a legally definable sense, genocidal. The result of this was an essay, actually. It's not a particularly long thing, but it's a very important thing. It's called On Genocide. It was published in Ramparts magazine in early 1968 and subsequently published in conjunction with an array of the data that had been amassed by the tribunal to illustrate the point as a small book. You can probably find it in used bookstores around in Montreal or Toronto or Amazon.com, for that matter. We are in this cyber age, and you can find all kinds of wonderful things out there. Yeah, you just need to pay for it. Okay. Sartre started by examining the nature of the U.S. strategy, which was rather blunt. Wasn't particularly elegant. It was a strategy of attrition. An attritional strategy, as was employed by Westmoreland in Southeast Asia, means simply you kill them and you kill them and you kill them and you kill them, and finally you will have killed enough that they can no longer sustain the fight. No finesse involved at all. Superior firepower. That's it. And on the face, not surprisingly, he determined that it was intrinsically genocidal to approach warfare in this fashion because the entire population was targeted. But he said, you know, this was a neocolonial endeavor. And this raises more questions for me. And so having, in about 5 pages, adduced that there was substance to the charges against the United States on the basis of genocide, legally defined, he went on to examine whether there wasn't a relationship inherent to colonialism, neocolonialism, these forms of domination on the one hand and genocide on the other. And he examined the French performance in Algeria primarily and a couple of other examples in a secondary sense, and he adduced the following equation, which was very, very controversial, as you can imagine, in the hallowed corridors of academia, particularly in the States, but to a certain extent up here as well, and that was that colonialism equals genocide. That if you impose and maintain a colonial order, you will inherently have to engage in lines of policy and action that will have a genocidal effect upon the subordinated population. Now, you got some cynical objections that were raised by people who knew better, and then you got another, and this is the majority of the objections that were raised to Sartre that made him so almighty controversial, because of a profound misunderstanding of the meaning of the term genocide. Most of the responses seem to be keyed to the notion that genocide is a synonym for Auschwitz, and that insofar as you could not discern Auschwitz per se in the course of most colonial endeavors, that genocide was an exaggeration or a misnomer in its application. I say that's a profound misunderstanding of the term because, well, let me put it to you this way. Auschwitz occurred in a particular context with regard to the Nazi Judeocide. And even in the context of that particular process, it was not paramount. About one-third of the people who died as a result of that Nazi policy died in Auschwitz or comparable camps of Operation Reinhardt, the extermination centers. About half of all the people who died as a part of that process died by way of malnutrition, lowered resistance to disease, and epidemic diseases that spread after being walled into ghettos, mostly in Poland, to a certain extent in the Baltic states. And the balance were shot and dumped into anti-tank ditches by the Einsatzgruppen in Eastern Europe. So even in the sense of, quote, the Holocaust, end quote, Auschwitz was not definitive. And Auschwitz, even in this distorted sense that it is used, is signifying of outright killing. And in the conceptualization of the term genocide by Raphael Lemkin in 1944, it is acknowledged that killing is a means to accomplish a genocide, of which there have been many historically, he said. It's not a unique process, but that's historically exceptional. Usually, it is undertaken by non-lethal means. Take a deep breath, and I'll repeat it. Genocide is usually undertaken by non-lethal means. In the legal codification in the 1948 Convention on Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, there are four different categories of state action elucidated as being genocidal. One and one only involves killing members of the target group. That's 20% of the definition. The other 80% involves non-lethal means. Genocide, as defined by Lemkin, and he coined the term, is any policy undertaken with the intent to bring about the dissolution and disappearance of a targeted population group. Now, that's refined to read racial, ethnical, national, or religious population groups. There's others conceivable, but they're not listed in the law. So it's probably worthwhile to run down what the other four criteria are so you understand the relationality that Sartre, having actually looked at the thing, was responding to when he equated colonialism and genocide. Now, these are aspects of the colonial order. I'll bounce back and forth between the United States and Canada, but since we're in Canada, I'll try to use Canada as point of reference where possible. The first of the five has to do with killing. Now, for those of you who'd say Canada didn't do much killing, that's okay. You can say it because it says killing members of the group simply on the basis of their membership in the group. Doesn't say how many you got to kill. Doesn't say what proportion you got to kill. Simply says you're targeting and killing people on the basis of their group membership. You're killing an Indian or you're killing a black or you're killing whoever you're killing simply because they're a black or they're an Indian. If you're doing that, it's not just murder, it's genocidal mode of murder. Meets the criteria, legally speaking. And that certainly has happened in Canada, hasn't it? Oh, yeah. And not just in the 19th century. Happened more in the United States. We can take that one right up. But it's a schoolyard polemic to say, well, they do it too, and they even did it worse than me. Okay, granted. Now you're still guilty. That's how that one works, boys and girls. Okay, now that we've gotten past third grade in terms of national polemic of defense, let's get to the ones that actually count, and let's talk a little bit about Canada's response to them. Second one is to implement a policy designed to impose severe physical or psychological harm upon the members of the target group. The idea being, if you can make it in a manner short of lethality, so uncomfortable for them to remain identifying members of the group that's been targeted, that they will voluntarily, and put quotes around that, disassociate themselves from the group. The group is ultimately going to go into a process of dissolution, and if that's carried far enough, disappear. Well, look at the economic statistics and so forth with regard to Aboriginal people in Canada over, say, I don't know, the last 100 years. And you start to get a little flickering there, a little glimmer maybe, that there's been some policy-driven mechanism that makes them rather physically uncomfortable. You could call it even severe physical harm. Since people are dying of malnutrition and easily curable diseases and such at astronomical rates in the context of an advanced industrial society, Okay? You want to talk about psychological harm? Well, turn on a TV. Now, Canada doesn't do all this. It just imports it and decides that it's okay to watch NFL football and the Washington Redskins, for example, and publish tumbleweed cartoons and run John Ford movies and buy Jeep Cherokees and Winnebago campers. And shall I continue? How many place names in Canada do you have that include the word squaw, and what does it mean? Come on, brave soul out there. I actually am asking a question, and it's not just professoral. This is actually part of the deal. Thank you. Yeah. You didn't have to go to anthropology class for that. You just needed to go down to Six Nations and ask them, because it's a word from there. Okay, and it means female genitalia. And it's used as hip slang by the settler population to address any indigenous female. Doesn't matter whether it's an elder woman, mother expectant, or a six-year-old little girl. And although most of the people using it at this point don't really understand what it means, a lot of us do, and you can imagine the degradation and so forth that goes with that. And when we object, we're told it's okay, like they said about the Redskins just yesterday, we intend to honor you with it. Yeah, well, try playing that little record in English translation in women's studies. Walk in and call a receptionist the translation of squaw in English and see where that gets you. And when the objection comes, tell her, what's your problem? I was just trying to honor you. Yeah. Psychological harm. And that's ubiquitous. It's endemic. It's defended. So there's those two. Third one doesn't target the people per se at all. It's to create conditions leading to the physical destruction of the group. So you're targeting that upon which the group depends for its survival as a group in being. Well, here's one condition you could do. How about a relocation program that is an incentive to take people off their land and disperse them in cities? I don't know what your data is up here, but it's probably pretty close to the United States. And in the United States, 55% of the entire population of recognized indigenous people is dispersed from the reservations into urban enclaves where they disappear. And that happens in every city in Canada as well, with the possible exception of Winnipeg, where there's damn near more Indians dispersed into the city than there are non-Indians administering to their affairs. You call Winnipeg the largest urban reservation in Canada if you want, but the point still stands. It's a dispersal, and a group cannot retain its integrity, its existence in being, if it's dispersed across a continent. You have a diaspora of Native people in North America that's been policy-driven and created for the purpose of dividing and weakening us, of undermining our culture and so forth. If that process in and of itself were simply carried to its conclusion, there would be no culturally identifiable indigenous people remaining in Canadian borders, a principle the United States figured out a long time ago. And I don't know how many of you actually have done much intensive legal study or study on Aboriginal policy in Canada, but what you'd find in comparison to the United States is everything the United States does, Canada does within the next 10 years. You read judicial opinion in Canada, you find them on Aboriginal affairs citing the Marshall decisions of the 1830s, which are definitive in the formation of federal Indian law in the United States. They're also formative in terms of Canadian Indian law. And let me tell you, that record doesn't play in reverse. You'll never find a Canadian precedent cited in a U.S. court. But Canadian precedent is riddled with reference to the U.S. So what I talk about when I talk about it in the U.S. applies to Canada in a more or less direct fashion. So dispersal is one. How about you attack the environment? How about, as with the Great Whale Project, when they planned that, you simply submerge the entire homeland of the people under about 150 feet of water for a hydro project? What happens to the people then? Well, I guess they get dispersed, but whatever else can be said, they cannot maintain their way of life and constitute themselves as a group and being projected into the future. That process of dissolution and ultimate disappearance as a recognizable human group is ushered in through that means. Fourth one has to do with preventing births among the target group. And as Lemkin pointed out, the reason we don't talk about genocide as a synonym for mass murder is And the reason you don't have to kill anybody in order to perform genocide is because, for example, you could simply biologically eradicate their capacity to reproduce, sterilize them, in other words. It's conceivable with a small target group, you simply sterilize everyone of childbearing age or younger. And you've killed no one, but at the end of a single generation, they go out of existence in biological terms as surely as if you'd stood them up against a wall and blown their brains out. Mark that one, because I'm coming back to it in terms of Canadian practice in a minute. And the fifth and final one has to do with the forced transfer of children from the targeted group to the targeting group, so they will be raised to understand themselves as someone other than who they were born to be. And I've got two words to say to everybody in Canada. Residential schools. Exactly the purpose stated in black and white repeatedly by officials in Canada was the residential schools were created, administered, and sustained for the specific purpose of destroying the cultural identity of every student who went through them. They were not entirely successful, although they caused incredible carnage, psychologically, intellectually, and otherwise. And they didn't get every student, but it was not for lack of trying. Yeah. So, 5 for 5, you got genocidal ingredients bound up in the Indian policy of the mega state of Canada, the settler state of Canada, the internal colonial state of Canada. And all of these 5 emerge as part and parcel of the colonial process, serving as a perfect validation for the Sartrean equation of colonialism to genocide. You need look no further than Canada to see the truth of the correlation he made. Canada has signed on to the Genocide Convention, unlike the United States. I come from the U.S., See, what I just ran down was a diluted version of what Lemkin had in mind as being a genocide convention. The United States and Canada primarily gutted the thing, and then the United States refused to sign it at all for 40 years, specifically because it knew it would be self-indicting, both on its Indian policy and with regard to its refusal to terminate the operations of the Ku Klux Klan and so forth, all of which could be construed as genocidal activity, either condoned and sanctioned or actually perpetrated by the U.S., and their response was, well, we'll just refuse to sign the law. Doesn't mean the law is not the law. How many of you signed a murder statute? Okay, I guess you can all run out and create mayhem. You haven't signed on, so you're exempted from compliance with the law. Well, that doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way for nation states either. But there's this little power equation. Okay? Canada, on the other hand, at least cosmetically endorsed the Genocide Convention, ratified it, and effected an implementing statute in 1952. Funny thing, though, I just ran down 5 criteria that are in the 48 Convention that was supposedly ratified and effected by domestic statute in Canada. The Canadian statute shows 3. And there's a real interesting little explanation of this in the parliamentary minutes. It's explained, actually, by representatives of the Canada Bar Association, ratified by the Parliament, that several of the criteria in the Exton Convention pertain to recent events in Europe. They're talking about what the Nazis did during the Second World War, and have no particular relevance to Canada. Okay? So we don't need them in our law. So what did they delete? Killing, for example. No, they kept killing. They weren't doing any killing, so it was okay to keep that one. It can be illegal since we're not doing it. What they deleted was the forced transfer of children and infliction of significant physical and psychological harm. They kept the ones they weren't doing. They deleted the ones they were guilty of. Interesting mode of legal compliance here. You just get to tailor the law to what it is you're not doing. 1986, the Canadian Genocide Statute was revised. They deleted sterilization. That ought to be setting off flares for somebody in the room. Anybody that would be opposed to involuntary sterilization targeted on people of economic and racial groups because they're considered to be objectionable surplus population, extraneous or whatever, you find that that is a violation of women's rights, of human rights, of other kinds of rights, as much as sent you a signal. We've implemented these things on the sly. That's why we removed the criteria of illegality from our enforcement statute. Do I have the specifics on that? No, I don't. I'm simply telling you, go look. They sent you a loud and clear message. I would suppose very few people in this room knew that. Well, now you do. Now you do. In opposition to genocide, one is compelled again to make priority number one the decolonization of indigenous people, because we are directly, internally colonized by the state. Insofar as we are maintained in a situation of colonial domination, we are being subjected to genocide. In the terms, in the forms just covered. But let me give you one, and then I'll close, example of the urgency of the situation. The conditions on the reserves are probably emblematized by this particular fact better than anything else I could imagine to say. 5 years ago in northern Manitoba, 7 in every 10 Aboriginal children on a reserve between the ages of 9 and 12 years old were actively engaged in inhaling gasoline, not only to obliviate their consciousness of the reality they were inhabiting in the moment, but in full knowledge that the effects were apt to be permanent. This is a figurative suicide that is affecting 70% of all reserve-based children in a Canadian province. In the data on other provinces like Labrador are not appreciably better. And you couple that to the literal suicide rate, which runs about 1,400% the national average in age group. And stop and ask yourself a real simple question. What is it that could be so horrible in the life of a 10-year-old child that they would intentionally, if not literally, take their life, attempt to blot out their consciousness because so that they would not have to deal with that reality ever, ever again? And if you answer that for one child, then try extrapolating it to 7 in every 10. That's the circumstance that we live with. That is a circumstance which, by any reasonable definition, is genocidal, and anyone of consciousness who would attempt, by whatever means are appropriate, to end the genocide has to make that decolonization process their top priority. So whether you look at it in terms of opposition to globalization, or you look at it in terms of the simple humanity of opposing genocide, or whether you look at it in terms of a progressive agenda item that you'd like to see fulfilled, no matter how you come at it from that triangulation, we have this particular priority, the irrevocable alteration of the structure of the megastate of Canada that is entailed in the decolonization of Aboriginal Canada, the fulfillment of self-determining rights of Aboriginals in Canada. There's no equivocation. There's no debate. There is a common interest in humanity, materially speaking, and in every other fashion to that. And if we can agree on that, we have a common ground from which we can go forward together to define what it is that is appropriate, what it is that's necessary, what it is that must be done to alter the situation in the manner that I just described, and forge together a future that is vastly more inhabitable, inviting for our children, a generation and 2 generations and 7 generations into the future than the ones we have inherited. That is a noble aspiration, and it is a fundamental human obligation, not just for Native people, but for all of us. Thank you.
How do you see nationalism playing into the arguments that you make, because I know, like, I'm familiar with some of the work you've done. I've read some of the books you've had. But the one thing I notice, just, you know, from being, living in Canada and heading to the States every so often, and especially after the 11th, is the whole concept of nationalism. Because now you got Native people in both countries saying, hey, I'm an American, I'm a Canadian, I'm a proud Canadian, right? And and it's really hard not to get caught up in that particular idea. And to me, I see nationalism as a major threat because, a good example, right? Most of the people who are surrounding me here are born in Canada or have been born in Canada, I'm making that assumption, right? They are Native Canadians, if we want to go use that term. And it's very hard for an Anishinaabe person. That's why I start using that term, because it's pointless using Native for someone who's been, you know, born here before I was, right? And you get that. We're hearing that all the time. Like, hey, we're proud Americans. You know, if you don't want to stick with us, then, you know, out of the boat you go. And, you know, and then I can see it kind of being turned. Like, if we think along those methods and try to approach people that way, we become branded. Like, oh, well, you're the next group of terrorists. Yeah, you're not Muslims yet, but we know you Indians are, you know, what you're up to. And we hear that. So I just want to get your perspective on that. You betcha.
Okay. Well, let me approach it this way. I know what you're talking about, and I live in the same environment, probably more so because I'm down there right now. You wouldn't believe what they're doing right now, you know. Now I know what it must have been like to live in Nuremberg. Yeah. Hey, nationalism. It's a polyglot of several things, including racism and cultural supremacism, but primarily it's statism. And you got this entity out there that's a perfect illustration of it. Called the United Nations. Every member of it is called a member state, accurately enough. You've got to be a state that is a centrally and arbitrarily organized geographic geopolitical entity in order to obtain membership. Nations need not apply. Should have been called the United States, but unfortunately for the organization, the name was already taken, you see. Right. So we have this conflation of nation and state, and they ain't the same thing. We're nations, they're states. There's a multiplicity of nations subordinated and amalgamated into the entities called the United States and Canada. And they purport nationalism, but what they mean is jingoism. Okay? So I oppose statism, or whatever the more appropriate term would be to describe these megastate realities, in the sensibility that aligns itself with them, takes pride in being a member of it, even though the other members of it are apt to lynch you. This is a real interesting phenomenon. It's psychological warp, okay, and an intellectual confusion that we desperately need to clarify. And I have the same problem you do in my own communities, you know. I watch the grand entries, and here come guys. I'm a combat veteran, okay? I ain't proud of it. You know, mind warp. I wouldn't have done the stuff I should never have done because I was warped into the process and learned where it was that my allegiance should lie in the process of that, and been opposing it ever since, okay? But I got people who are the same generation I am still being proud of that, thinking they're upholding a warrior tradition by fighting for the colonizers, the people their ancestors fought against, who perpetrated the massacres and pursued the scalp bounties and all the rest of that. Somehow or another, joining them has become a signifier of pride, and that just shows the level of confusion that's been imposed upon it and how much work we got to do to take the American flag and helmets and stuff like that out of grand entries of our own get-togethers. Okay? And that's part of that process of decolonization. There's other colonial peoples that we can use as examples and lenses. The Irish, for example, ended up being a shock troops used against us. They were dispersed from their own country as a result of colonization by the British and ended up fighting under British arms, and ultimately the 7th Cavalry for the United States, and so on, the Wild Geese. They were mercenary soldiers. They're proud of it, and that pride is confusion, but they're now harnessed to their own liberation struggle, and that's what we got to do with our own people. Okay. This is not to say you can't learn some good skills in that military apparatus, and maybe, you know, in consciousness, some of us want to go in from time to time anyway. Okay, but that's a different thing altogether from the phenomenon you're talking about.
I was wondering what decolonization would practically and concretely look like, and what role descendants of those settlers, such as myself, could play, besides awareness of the issues and dialogue with our friends and families about the reality of what's happening and what has always been happening ever since we first came onto this continent. So I was just wondering what concretely that process, that very necessary process, would look like.
Concretely, it would look like such a diversity that I couldn't possibly explain it, and I'm not empowered to speak in behalf of people who have their own perception of interest and how they should go about things in the world themselves. That's part of what self-determination is that each people determines for itself how it's going to be in the world, what its relations are going to be to other people, and I'm not certainly in a position to speak for them. That would nullify their self-determination in the same sense some bureaucrat sitting in Ottawa speaking for them nullifies it. Okay, it's the inverse of self-determination. The crucial first step towards decolonization, north of that funny little line they call a border, or south of it, either one, is, by God, law enforcement. Big laws, not the little ones about buckle your seatbelts and put your cigarettes out and all the rest of that stuff. I'm talking about the ones that have to do with the treaties. I'm talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I'm talking about the Genocide Convention. I'm talking about people doing what's necessary to enforce them upon the damn government. And if they're in compliance with the major laws, the decolonization process has already been inaugurated. We're placed in a position to exercise our right to self-determination. What that exercise is going to look like, of course, I can't address, but what I can address is our absolute entitlement to the exercise, and that's what it is. It's your responsibility to create, because ultimately it's your society as a settler that has created the nullification of it. How you go about it, I don't know you. I can't speak to your aptitudes and inclinations and so forth. Looks to me like you got a trigger finger, so there's one possibility. Looks to me like you got a mind as well, so there's another pull. Figure out between those two pulls what you're best suited to do and do it.
Thanks for speaking tonight. I certainly learned a lot. In the past, I believe you said that any state that's come to power through force of arms can only be removed through force of arms. What in practice?
I'm not sure I said it exactly that way, but that would be close enough that I'll accept it. How's that?
Okay, good. In practical terms, and for someone who is at Wounded Knee, what does that mean for this movement?
Were you at Wounded Knee?
No, weren't you?
No.
Oh, I thought you said you were earlier.
No.
I said, sorry.
I was on Pine Ridge. Wounded Knee is a particular location. Actually, Wounded Knee signifies a particular event or process. I was not there.
Oh, pardon me.
Okay.
I'll take that one back. But in any event, what does that mean for the movement that you represent or that you're part of?
What does Wounded Knee mean? Or
No. The statement that I quoted you, that I paraphrased.
Well, simplest version is you're not going to take something that maintains itself by force of arms and persuade it to go away. You're not going to mount a moral argument. You're not going to mount some argument of logical persuasion. You're not going to have a prayer vigil. You're not going to write a song. You're not going to be able to undertake a dietary change. You're going to be able to shift around in your wardrobe or get a different kind of fuel-consuming car, or any of the rest of that that's going to fundamentally change the relations of power. And the fact that the relations of power as they exist are maintained by armed force by the state of Canada. There are no disarmed confrontations occurring in Canada, nor have there ever been. One side of the equation is always and invariably armed. It's called the police. And behind that, there's whatever your version of the National Guard is, and behind that there's the Canadian Army, Air Force, and whatever other military appurtenances the state may be able to wield. And you can ask the people that were on the Mercer Bridge at Oka about them bringing tanks out about that. You have to adjust to that reality and figure out if you're actually going to defeat this thing, what you're going to have to do it. Now, I can stand here and commit sedition in Canadian terms and get myself deported before I get to Kingston tomorrow night, or I can leave you to use your imagination as to what it means from there, and I bet you'll do pretty well.
Thanks, Ward.
Yes, sir.
I just want to bring attention to a website called annett55.freewebsites.com. That's annett55.freewebsites.com.
Okay.
What you will find there is a detailed history of the genocide carried out in the Canadian residential school system by the church and the churches in the state, from the Gradual Civilization Act of the Upper Canada Legislature in 1857. to the statement by Duncan Campbell Scott, the superintendent of Indian Affairs, about their policy being aimed at the final solution of our Indian problem. But what he talks about through all the documents that are being added constantly to this website is the fact that there was not just cultural genocide, whatever that talks about, there was mass murder.
Sure.
And mass murder perpetrated against little children in a way that they could not reveal what was going on. The so-called abuse that went on was a campaign of terror to silence the people who were in fact being murdered and exterminated. And the method they used, of course, is the deliberate infection, the deliberate use of infectious diseases and failure to treat them, and the elimination of any possibility of treatment. So there is nothing I have seen so far that was perpetrated under the regime of Nazi Germany that is any worse or even the equal of what was done in the residential school systems, particularly in Western Canada. I'll let that go.
Well, I won't get with you to assessing it in terms of better or worse. To me, there is no better or worse genocide. But aside from that, there was nothing I would disagree with in what you just said, and I think it was a good citation. I would encourage people to follow up on it or go down to a bookstore and grab Roland Christian's Circle Game or any of a number of books that have recently come out that actually go into details and document what was done in the residential schools. But I'd like to take up another end of it because they have closed the schools by and large now. And I suppose in a way I need to say good, but another way I'm going to say so what? Because what they were doing to 5- and 6- and 7-year-old little kids. And we're talking about the inculcation of a fundamental primal level of psychic trauma that is insurmountable. They were taking these people and reducing them to psychological jelly by design. Some of them they would reconstruct. Some of them were unreconstructable when they were done. And when they finished with the processing through the residential schools, they spat them out into a society unprepared in most cases to function as Native people and unacceptable in terms of a racist white paradigm that rejected them on the basis of their heritage and their skin color, leaving them nowhere and no way of resolving the trauma. But they got to, as human beings, either self-destruct altogether or try to compensate some way. And one of the best ways you can try to compensate is form a human bond and establish a family. But you're incapable of functioning in the familial context as an effective human being. And so what you end up doing is abusing your family and transmitting the trauma that was inculcated in you in the residential school onto the next generation. The trauma is transmissible. And the damage didn't stop because they closed the schools. That's what's affecting a lot of those kids up in Labrador. That's what's affecting a lot of those kids up in northern Manitoba. And it is materially destructive. It is psychologically destructive. And it is lethal. And it correlates to something else that's rather interesting if you think about it, and not many people do. That is, in the last generation of the residential schools, about 50% of all Native children were processed through them. According to the official data right now, actually I think it's a little bit low, but officially speaking, about 50% of all Aboriginal people in Canada right now are either currently or have been acute alcoholics, which is a classic response to unresolvable trauma. I think if you did a list of that last generation that went through the residential schools and you were able to compile a list of acute alcoholics in the Native community, you would find that the correspondence would be virtually perfect. Either the people who came through or processed through the residential schools or their offspring constitute the alcoholic population. These are not sick people. They are not culturally defective people. They are not anything but wounded people. And the healing is going to have to come in another way. It's going to have to come in another way than forming another official or academic commission to run around and study what's defective in the Aboriginal culture to generate so much alcoholism and despair. The answer for the dominant society is simply to step up, take a deep breath, look in the mirror, and really pay attention to what's staring back. Because that's the cause, that's the source. And a maintenance of the order of business as usual that's predicated on that basis can only replicate, perpetuate that agony into the future. Now, I won't say anything other than this with respect to that. If you can be oblivious, acquiescent, and comfortable in the face of that reality, you are, in fact, a Nazi.
Ward, I was just curious to know, seeing that the American ideology, it doesn't work too well as it's based on greed, rape, and pillage of the rest of the world, what would you see as a proper ideology so that people can live in peace and coexist, and that the basis of growing up is not so that, you know, you just make as much money as you can and screw everyone else?
I wouldn't look at it in terms of ideology, okay? But I think maybe you're not using the word with that sort of rigor, so we'll let that one pass. An alternative view, let's just call it that. I would tell you to go out to someplace in a traditional setting where they've been able to still keep control over the basis of subsistence economy and so forth so that they could live in their own way in the world. But the fact of the matter is they don't need you coming in to look at them any more than they need a bunch of government bureaucrats or anthropologists. But think about it. The counter models are there. The counter models are being destroyed. It doesn't mean that somehow or another you can sit down and read a lot of books and talk to a couple of elders and watch a TV program or six and somehow or another come out being somebody of a completely different culture than you were born into. What it does mean is that there are concrete lessons that you can extract from the nature of their experience and way of going about relating to the world and being in the world that can be applied to you, whatever cultural context you happen to be in. But it's not simply a matter of opting out of a cultural matrix and becoming somebody else. Even in that sense, you've got to destroy the matrix, which is foreclosing upon the future of those counter models. You've got to struggle on your hands. One other way to do it, if there are any Christians who have snuck into the room or anyone who, like me, was indoctrinated with it as a child, okay? No, don't worry. I'm not going to get you all into Bible studies tonight. All you have to do is look at the first page of the book and everything on page one of Genesis. That's the very first page of the Bible. Just turn it around backwards and you got the key. Okay, it's right there. No, we are not in the image of God. Okay, so you cannot extrapolate that God's created in the image of us either. Okay? And insofar as you've got that relationality, you can't decide that we're God in this world. And on the basis of that, apart from and standing above nature and empowered and even obliged to exercise dominion over all of it, okay, by working our will and transforming it from what it is to something we can consume and turn into shit. Okay? No. Just look at it, read it entirely backwards, and you got your recipe. Okay.
Ani.
Hope.
The question I have is the one thing that I see frequently, and this particularly relates to a lot of websites on National Post, different forums, so-called scholarly forums or political forums. And the one thing that I find is that there's an extreme amount of racism, especially when there's anonymity there with the people that are on the other side. You don't see, so they're basically hidden. I see it more so than I see it in public. In public, it seems to be more of a polite tolerance in comparison than on specific forums. You see the true beliefs coming out of a lot of the population in Canada. Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing that I have a question about is there seems to be very little understanding in regards to Aboriginal issues, in regards to Aboriginal genocide in Canada. In the 20th century alone, for example, even in the 1970s, in regards to sterilization policies in British Columbia and Alberta, or in regards to the 60s scoop where children were removed from their homes by child welfare agencies in astronomical numbers, not to mention residential schools where children died between 25 and 45% from tuberculosis and never being treated. The one thing is that a lot of mainstream society refuses to even get out of that denial or even look at addressing those issues. You know, we have Walkerton. We have the tainted blood scandals where millions and millions of dollars are going to assist those people that have suffered from those things. But when it comes to Aboriginal issues in residential schools, you're lucky if anybody even sees any help in their lifetime. How can you possibly help to change the Eurocentric views that would assist to educate the mainstream public?
I don't have a cosmic answer to that. I really don't. Don't have command of a media empire or any of the rest of it. They do. The only way I know to go at it is the way I'm going at it here tonight, or the way I go at it when I'm neurotically sitting there, scribble, scribble, scribble at my word processor in a figurative sense and trying to put things out to make that communication and to rely on people who are the receivers of what it is that I say and what is I write and what it is that I incorporate from what they say and so on into what I do in that interchange to amplify it and expand it. See, this isn't entertainment. This is a part of the work. It's part of the struggle. And participation it carries with the obligation to take it on out of this room and put it to work in some other way. And that can be by talking, and that can be by other things as well. And preferably by talking and other things as well. And that's the only recourse we got right now. That and survival.
You know, I won't go into it, but I am a survivor of Indian residential school. I'm originally from Saskatchewan. I'm from the Standing Buffalo Band. And I was sent here when I was 14, and I was here for 5 years. I was sent to a home for emotionally disturbed kids. You know, and I hear people in the audience, they talk about, you know, well, why are they drinking? Why are they sniffing glue? Why? Well, I'll tell you why. If you were to lose your family, your mother and father at 6 years of age, and you were to be passed on from one institution, one home, from another to another and to another, till you didn't even know, you know, who these people are that are passing you along. But you know something? We remember. We remember our mothers and we remember our fathers. And that's why I'm standing here today, is because more and more, like you said, our past means something. And what our past was, we are today. And I'm thankful that I remember. I'm thankful I remember my grandmother. I'm thankful I remember where I came from. Because I always say I'm from Saskatchewan, and when I was born, we had no tele-anything. We had no telephone, no television, no nothing to tell us anything except about that land that we lived on. And it was only sky and land and us. And I think as human beings, if we don't start getting back to that land and sky and us, there ain't going to be nothing to get back to. So right now, tonight, we're all here as human beings, and you're all here to be educated about something, just like I am. And that, I think that education is what is going to actually save us. Because if we don't start doing something about the education, all you people sitting here who think you've got freedom, you know, because you had a town where you can call your own, and you have parents that you can say, well, I came from this place. Well, you know, us indigenous people in this land, we look all over this land, and I see my brother over there. I see another brother over there. I've seen sisters walk out of here. And you know something? If there's anything that keeps me rooted, it's where I come from. And I may be in Ontario because the government, the policies of this country, sent me here. But I don't forget, and I know where I came from. And I know the people that live in this area, these indigenous people that live here. You and even me are visitors here. And if we're to do anything for the place that we live in, let's start getting educated about the people who actually this is their land. There's many people here, indigenous people. You know, this gathering place we call Toronto, that's what it's called, the gathering place, Toronto. And we've all gathered here, and we've gathered here the gathering of the minds. I live on a street called Concord Street. It's called Gathering of the Minds. And when we have a chance, let's just say something. You know, when you see your brothers out there on the street, empty pockets, nowhere to go at night to sleep, those are people of this land. They even don't even have a place to put their head at night. Now, if we can't take out something of our pocket and give to that person, and all we can say about them is, well, they have a choice to drink. Well, maybe at some point they didn't have that choice, and that was their only choice. It's up to us as human beings to show the compassion that was shown to the people that came here to this land. Because if we didn't feed the Europeans, if our ancestors didn't feed those Europeans, you wouldn't be here.
I am known in Canada as Canadian Indian, who Columbus could not find.
Uh-huh. You owe us a thank you note for that, you know. And thank God he wasn't looking for turkey.
Well, I'm sorry, I was on the other side. Anyway, I think I really enjoyed your talk and your eloquence in talking about genocide by non-lethal means. But that was going on before September 11, too.
Surely.
Yeah. And September 11 was a big crime. But I think terrorism began on October 7th. And if terrorism began on October 7th, now they have a list of 60 countries on it. I would say that's genocide by lethal means. And it's happening now, here, in this planet.
I would not disagree, although I would take issue with the date of October 7. I think there's about 500,000 Iraqi children that would speak to the fact it was going on a little before then. And in fact, I can string the list all the way back to the Dutch kicking the heads of Wappinger Indians in a game of kickball along the street that becomes known as Wall Street because of the enclosure of the slave market that sits at the foot of where the World Trade Center once was 350 years ago. The genocide can be traced back that far. But as to what began on October 7th and what's been going on in Iraq and those things that were in the frame of reference, temporally speaking, of our ability to act, the only thing we can do ultimately to interrupt that process is change the capacity of the power that's projecting that lethal mode of genocide, where it lives and where it counts, not by arguing that it's wrong there, but arguing that it will not occur here. That's it.
You've just been listening to a talk by Professor Ward Churchill, Meet the New Boss, Same as the Old Boss, Globalization, Genocide, and Resistance, given last month in Toronto. Thanks to Neil Mather and Radio Cognito for that tape.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. They'll take no money.